Why'd you do it?
I didn't, since you ask.
You gonna fit right in. Everybody in here is innocent. You know that?
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective's look at the film adaptations of different seasons. Part of Percolated Media's Stephen King Retrospective series.
I'm sorry. It's just that I've heard all of these stories before.
Join Garrett.
The colossal prick even managed to sound magnanimous.
Matt.
Why do they call you that?
Maybe it's because I'm Irish.
And Adam.
I guess I just miss my friend.
As they continue going through the popular author's cinematic interpretations of his work by reviewing the three films adapted from one of King's most well-regarded collection of stories.
I'm never going to get out of this town, am I, Corey? You can do anything you want, man. Yeah, sure.
Included in this series are 1994's The Shawshank Redemption.
In 1966, Andy Dufresne escaped from Shawshank Prison.
1998's Apt Pupil.
Do you ever wonder why people do the things they do?
And 1986's Stand By Me.
Sleeper hold! Sleeper hold!
Oh, I'm serious!
No one gets that in the sleeper hold!
Keep coming back, podcast listeners, as we will continue going through all of Stephen King's adapted works in publication order.
Thank you for the most enchanting evening.
Are you guys ready to talk about a dead body?
I'll smack him.
The Percolated Media Different Seasons series begins now.
I find I'm so excited I can barely sit still to hold a thought in my head.
The Shawshank Redemption was released September 23rd, 1994. Budget was $25 million. Box office, its initial run, $16 million. Ouch. But it's eventually grossed $73.3 million. And this was directed by Frank Darabont. Gentlemen, remember way back when we did that Night Shift collection and we did a movie called Woman in the Room, directed by the one and only Frank Darabont. The seeds were set, and 7 years later, he would actually do The Shawshank Redemption. Paid King $5,000 for the rights to the story. We'll talk about where that $5,000 went, but that's quite a story as well. But Adam, we were just talking before we hit record on this thing. Did you know this was even a King production at the time this was released?
I don't think I knew this was a King production for 20 years after this thing was released. At the time that it was coming out, let me see, I would have, based on my teenage years, parents being gone, lived with, yeah, there was no way that I was going to go see this, knew that King was involved, and hearing about it afterwards is one of those movies everybody's got to see, it's IMDb ranking when that came out, yada yada. I didn't know this was a King thing until probably about the time that The Green Mile came out, because I was actually buying those novellas off the grocery store stand. And I think people were making correlations, and I was like, oh, I didn't know he wrote that. So I've never really known, and I don't think it matters.
Now, Matt, around the time this was hitting number one on IMDb, you would have been around the time that you would have been getting into movies. How much were you aware of The Shawshank Redemption?
Well, fortunately, I knew because I read Different Seasons as curriculum in high school. I think it was a sophomore or junior. So I knew not only this was a Stephen King property, but I knew of its reputation before I saw the movie. And then when in conjunction with the IMDb Top 250, seeing it's number one, that kind of sets you off to check it out if you've never seen it before. But I'm sure I echo a lot of people's sentiments that if it wasn't for the reading the book, I probably would not have known going into this it was a Stephen King adaptation, because it's not called Stephen King's The Shawshank Redemption. His name is not on the poster. So it's also not his typical output as far as genre or style, because this is a novella. You know, it's in between a short story and a novel. So it's kind of a outlier in a lot of his typical circles.
Now, by this time, Rob Reiner had done Stand By Me. He had done Misery. And at this point, he had established Castle Rock Productions. And there was a point of time, gentlemen, where Stephen King, before he would release any story that he did, he would send them directly to Castle Rock first, saying, I'll give you guys first crack if you want this. They would make Needful Things. They would make Dolores Claiborne. They would make a number of adaptations, mostly rejected, but some of them they made. And at the time Darabont got the rights to this in 1987, he wrote a script, and it made its way to Castle Rock. Rob Reiner really, really wanted to make this movie, to the point where he had just released A Few Good Men, and he had appointed Tom Cruise as the Andy Dufresne role. He was going to make it, but Darabont was adamant. And this is kind of, we're going to talk about Sylvester Stallone here pretty soon with Rocky. This is kind of a Stallone story where Rob Reiner offered him $3 million. And at this point, Darabont needed that $3 million more than anything. He wanted so bad to take it and let Reiner make it, but he said he had a vision for it. Even King himself, when he got the rights, told Darabont, look, I don't know how you can make this into a narrative, but if you want them, here you go. But Darabont stuck to his guns, and Rob Reiner eventually said, okay, go ahead, make your movie. I'm not going to get in your way. Darabont went and made it, and people think, we're not going to talk about Rob Reiner here for a couple of weeks, but I do have a mini Rob Reiner story that Darabont told around the time that Reiner had passed away. After this huge fight, well, not fight, just kind of a back and forth about whether Reiner was going to make this film, and Darabont finally won him over with his passion to make it, Rob Reiner said, okay, go ahead, make your movie. Around this time, Reiner had done an adaptation of his friend's book, North. That was his consolation prize. A week before the first screening of this movie, there was a screening of North that was a well-known abomination of a screening. People walked out. People yelled, I don't know what you're trying to do with this movie. There was a lot of negativity surrounding that movie's release, and eventually has a well-known Siskel and Ebert episode where Ebert just ripped it to shreds. A week later, Darabont was supposed to show him this because Castle Rock was going to release it. For the whole 2.5 hours of this movie, Darabont sat in the back of a room and saw the back of Rob Reiner watching this movie. The movie's over. Rob Reiner stands up, shakes his hand with tears in his eyes, and says, that is the best thing that Castle Rock has ever attached its name to. And he walks out. If that's not the definition of class, Adam, when it comes to Rob Reiner, I don't know what is.
Absolutely. Especially when, I mean, he wanted to make it. So it's one of a multitude of stories about the guy. He has a run that is almost unprecedented, and this could have been another one in, you know, that hat, but I do think this went the right way, and it's amazing because people know Castle Rock, Castle Rock, Castle Rock, but then you're like, wait a minute, Castle Rock, that, I mean, that was the change for him, and I think it's fantastic. I really do. Class act.
We'll never know, I'm sure. If North was not the consolation, like, let's say he made The American President next as his next movie, I think history would be a little bit kinder on that respect, but when you make something as derided as North to the point where 30-something years later, Elijah Wood still talks about it, and he was like 10 when he made that movie, its reputation is well-earned. But also, if you're looking at it from Reiner's perspective, he had done Stand By Me and Misery, which garnered strong critical praise across the board from both King himself and critics and audiences alike. So I could see him wanting to go for the hat trick because of the three, it kind of would have made sense because both Stand By Me and Shawshank are part of different seasons. And it'd be interesting to see if the same voice doing both novellas would have the same effect over both. But you know, we'll never know. In the same way, we'll never know this movie if Tom Cruise was in front of the camera.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that here in a bit, but I do want to mention that, you know, me and Adam were kind of talking, Matt, before you got on this call for this review. This was not even on our lips at the time that it was released, and me and him were pretty good friends around this time. I think it's telling that, as you mentioned, King's name is nowhere near the marketing for this. He's not even on the poster. I think at this point, Matt, it's safe to say that they were trying to get as far away from him as possible when they were releasing this, right?
Well, I wouldn't say far enough away, because his name had sort of, He had a bit of a comeback when you look at some of the films that were being made. But at the same time, maybe the fact that this wasn't horror gave Castle Rock and the distributors more of an excuse to not put his name on here to try to sell the movie. Which, in hindsight, wasn't a good decision because it infamously did not do well.
Yeah, the film's released, earns only $3 million its first weekend, and something like $200,000 its first night. It really does look like a failure. But The thing that turned it around was they got nominated for a multitude of Oscars, I believe 7 nominations that year. In 1994, which we've talked about in chats, we've talked about on this podcast, boys, 1994 was quite the year for movies.
Mm-hmm. You look at the 5 films nominated for Best Picture, it's a great list, but they 4 of the 5, and of course, the I think the worst one is the one they picked for Best Picture. But you look at the fact it was also at the time where the Oscars carried a lot of weight, mm-hmm. as far as getting the general populace to go see movies, because it was an endorsement, and it wasn't as well known that like the politics and the campaigning of Oscars, that wouldn't happen until like 98 with Shakespeare in Love. So that really helped, combined with, you know, rental copies were a huge part of film's second life after theaters. And it's kind of one of those movies where it's hard to think of a person that you can't recommend it to, because it's kind of made to appeal to everybody who's of age. Like, certainly you're not going to show this to a 7-year-old, but like general adults, like it's got a lot of things that had little that would draw people away from going to check it out.
I think really this is one of the ones where it changed a little bit. You know, Oscars have always been pay to play. I don't know. Even using that term might get me a cease and desist letter, you know, because of how anal they are. But it's well known that you can buy an Oscar if you know how to pay for the right party, and that's part of the marketing budget. And this one didn't really do that, but still got recognized by some that needed to. And it's one of the films that made people go, oh, this can be used. Even just a nomination, like maybe you don't need to win, but a nomination can really get attention and can be worth what you spend to get your box office up. So I think it almost changed the way that Oscar campaigning has been done.
Yeah, they say that getting an Oscar nomination adds $20 million to your box office take. So I do think that's a big part of it. Another thing that cannot be overlooked, there would not be a month that goes by that you don't watch an episode of Nitro, and eventually on TNT, you would see a run of this movie. I think this movie got the most play of any movie after Turner bought Castle Rock, and they had this film's rights, and Adam, they played it all the fucking time, didn't they?
They did, and I knew it was always on there, and guess what, everybody? Regardless of it, I didn't see it until last year, that before, because it was always on, and I'm like, oh, that's that prison movie, click, and looking into it, yeah, that good old cowboy Ted, he bought it, and then he's like, wait, this is one of the most popular rentals ever? Well, I can sell it to myself for pennies on the dollar to my own network, but I can still charge massive amount of advertising dollars because of it. And this thing made ridiculous amounts of money for Turner Broadcasting, and then in turn for everybody involved with it. It's nuts. I know Warden, he talked about how for like years afterwards, he would get 6-figure residuals because of how this thing played.
Yeah, Bob Gunton, I just heard an interview with him where he mentioned that. It's crazy.
It's brilliant on Ted Turner's, because 97 was the first year they started, and that was the height of Nitro. That was when they were, mm-hmm. you know, on top for 83 weeks or whatever it was. So that was brilliant, because Nitro was watched by an older demographic compared to like what Raw was until Attitude fully took hold. So you're getting as large of an audience as possible and exposing them to something that maybe otherwise they wouldn't check out, but because it was constantly in your face, I guess like wrestling, you tap out and finally give in. Like, the pain's too much.
Now, when Rob Reiner initially was going to make this, he had Tom Cruise in mind to play the Andy character. Matt, you're aware of who we wanted as the red character, right?
Harrison Ford,
right? Good old Harrison Ford. Matt, how do you feel that tandem would have worked?
I could see it for both of them, because this was during the time where Harrison Ford still gave a shit consistently. You know, I think of stuff like The Fugitive and, you know, Witness, Mosquito Coast, Working Girl. Like, I'm tired of people who only know Harrison Ford from Star Wars and Indiana Jones. That always bothered me, because he's got a great body of work outside of that. And this was still at the time where Tom Cruise was an actor first and a brand second. So I think this actually would have been an interesting combination. And I think it would have worked in an alternative type of way. I don't think either would have been a bad choice.
I agree, and I agree for the same reasons. I think both of them were doing some very artistic work back then. And if you look at what Tom Cruise did with Born on the 4th of July, And everybody involved with that movie getting robbed of the Oscar, still will say, years later. And Harrison Ford, I mean, doing his thespian work as opposed to his blockbuster work. Yeah, it could have worked. I think Cruise more than Ford, but I think Ford as well could have absolutely brought it.
Now, getting to Frank Darabont as director of this, he had written scripts for The Blob, Nightmare on Elm Street 3. He was not a well-proven director. So Morgan Freeman gave him a lot of shit for a particular scene that we'll talk about when we get to it. But another person who did not really want Darabont on this was Cruise himself, because he did attend a script read of this. But when Rob Reiner said he's backing up, he's letting this guy take the reins, Cruise said, since he's unproven, I don't want to be a part of it anymore. So he backed out, and we get Tim Robbins here. And Tim Robbins brought his buddy, Roger Deakins, from the Hudsucker Proxy. And, you know, we're going to talk about it when we get to the movie, but Matt, I think Roger Deakins brings a lot to this, don't you?
I think a lot of the staying power of this movie is the imagery and some of the particular scenes. And I think a lot of that is because of Roger Deakins' work on this movie. And I think it's I know we talk about snubs all the time, but it's kind of baffling he didn't win the Oscar for this. Because it would have been like the Oscar's typical like consolation prize. If a movie's not going to win Best Picture, they'll find a way to give it something else. But it didn't. And the Tim Robbins thing was interesting because he had only done, like, Jacob's Ladder was the big thing before this. He had done The Player and Howard the Duck. Like, they're very Bull Durham. Like, looking at that track record, I wouldn't see him in this particular role. And going from Tom Cruise to Tim Robbins is weird because it's like a foot difference in height.
Yeah. Tim Robbins is 6'5".
Yeah, like he's a really tall guy and has a different presence than Tom Cruise does. So it's a weird 180 to go from one to the other.
Yeah, Tom Cruise being cast would have definitely made what happens at the end of this movie much more believable. I'll just put that out there. You know, we are taking quite the 180 here because last week we reviewed one of the most derided movies in King's adapted oeuvre in The Dark Tower, and here we have one of its most praised. And to say this thing's gotten a reappraisal would be an understatement. It is on a lot of people's top 10 lists as their favorite movies of all time. I was one that, you know, when I read this story, which, by the way, let me get one pet peeve out of the way real quick. This is a huge pet peeve.
You're talking about the title?
Yeah, well, I'm talking about the title of the story.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, yeah. One thing, like, this boggles me. It pisses me off as much as people clapping in a movie theater. It pisses me off as much as people who root for a team claim that they're part of the team. They say we. When people say this title, they call it Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption. No, it is Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption. This might be my reason for my heart problems later on in life, but this really fucking pisses me off when I hear that.
I think the change for the translation into a movie, condensing the title, I think was a smart move because Rita Hayworth was well past her sell-by date at this point. And The Shawshank Redemption is such a intriguing title because it doesn't really indicate what the movie is about. I mean, you can kind of with the last word, but there's a certain ambiance to that, a certain amount of mystery that I think kind of drew people in when they saw the ads for it. You're like, okay, what the hell does that actually mean? When you put Rita Hayworth in Shawshank Redemption, it's like, how do these two things go together on the surface?
Yeah, in fact, Darabont said that when he put this script out and he held auditions, people came in, like, they thought maybe Rita Hayworth was a character in the movie. So they would come, they had these chicks come in, and they also had guys in drag come in and try to win the part of Rita Hayworth. But no, she only plays a small part on the outline of this film. But yeah, we're going into different seasons with this movie. A story collection that, Matt, is it safe to say, is probably amongst King's most praised, right?
Well, it's certainly one of his most acclaimed. When you look at, I mean, three of the four got adaptations, all of them big productions to varying degrees. All of them have qualities to them, and they're all different. That's the one thing I really like about different seasons. And they're also, unlike Night Shift or Skeleton Crew, they're considerably longer than his typical short stories. I think this one's almost 100 pages.
Yes.
And I think the other three, Breathing Method's the shortest by far, because that one's also it's the shortest, but it's also the only one that hasn't been adapted, because my question is, how the hell do you do that as a feature film?
Yeah, there was talk that Scott Derrickson was going to adapt that for a set of years, and then he just kind of dropped out of it, and then we haven't heard word about it ever since. Yeah, that is a really weird story. That is probably the closest story to horror that's in that book.
Well, it's the only one that's supernatural.
Yeah.
And I think that's why a lot of people also like it, is that they're very human stories. Like, there's no supernatural components to them. There's certain legend about almost a folktale aspect to Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption that is magnified in the movie, but they're steeped in reality.
Yeah. Adam, to give you a hint about the breathing method, it tells the story of, there's this round table of doctors getting together and telling stories. And one doctor tells a crazy story of the breathing method, which is Lamaze class. And Lamaze had just pretty much come into vogue around that time. And he tells a story of a woman being beheaded in a car accident, yet doing the breathing method as her kids being born. How you adapt that, I don't know. Maybe it would make a good Tales from the Crypt episode, Tales from the Dark Side, Twilight Zone, whatever. But yeah, I definitely see how people would not be able to adapt that story.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's nuts. But let's get to The Shawshank Redemption, which, by the way, Tim Robbins did say it was hard for him to sell this in interviews because he would get confused with the title all the time. And a lot of people do say that the title was a reason why this thing did not make as much money at the time is, what the hell is The Shawshank Redemption? So, Matt, I think making it kind of a mystery box kind of worked against it, didn't it?
Yes. And another thing, there's no women in this movie at all.
No.
This is purely a male-dominated film, and I'm sure that maybe condensed the accessibility or the interest. And it was a long time since we had like the last like big prison movie before this. You'd have to go back to like Brubaker with Robert Redford.
Oh, wow.
At least from what I can think of, because there was a period like during the you know, the 60s through like the 80s where you some of the most famous movies of those periods and the ones that have lived on were prison films. Cool Hand Luke, Escape from Alcatraz, which is ironic because Clint Eastwood was considered for this movie. Mm-hmm. Brubaker, like I said, you had Bad Boys with Sean Penn. You know, a lot of really interesting films that this, you know, came out a little bit after. There was a big gap between Brubaker and this. So I think that combined with being strictly a male-driven film also contributed to it not doing so well.
All right, boys, let's get into it. So we open up outside a house as we see Tim Robbins parked on the outside. We see him open a cloth with a gun in it as he takes a few drinks as we cut to the trial. He says that his wife wanted a divorce in Reno. Boy, I know how that's what that's like. And that she packed a bag to go and stay with a golf pro. He says that he went to a few bars and parked at the turnout to scare them. And in the book, he does this to commit suicide. He is on his way to committing suicide. He says he was sobering up and drove home before throwing the gun in the river. And the cleaning lady found the bodies with .38 caliber bullets in them. And they dragged the river without finding a gun. All right. So this opening, already I'm feeling like, why? Because the majority of this, 99.5% of this, is narrated by Morgan Freeman. Why are we opening in a whole different bit of narrative? Boggles my mind. I think this would have been better left as a mystery.
Well, the problem is also, I never believe that he actually committed this crime. Even before you find out there's a definitive answer. Like, I don't think the movie does a good job of selling this at all. And it's a problem I have with the perspective. And this gets into my, I hate to lead with this, but since we're there, the book is, Red is the main focal point of the book, or the novella, excuse me. And that's a weird thing in the translation process to do here, because a lot of this movie is fragmented with different characters. Like, there's a pretty big cast in this, and certain characters get, they're almost like their own vignettes. And it's weird, though, because Andy, outside of Red, is the other, like, main character, but the movie, I don't feel like it's being told through Red's perspective when Andy's at the focal point, unlike in the novella. So I have a problem with that, because it feels off-putting that the rest of the movie is clearly told through Morgan Freeman's character.
What I wish they did differently at the beginning is kind of just have part of the trial. I don't need to see the wife and the golf pro or him in the car. Like, just make it more like The Fugitive, where you got him in court, you have that, you have the sentence, and then moving on. I just don't think it does a lot. I think it feels a little disjointed compared to the rest of the movie. I have a different take, because at the end of the movie, I think he actually did it.
Really?
That's me. I haven't read the book. So there's a line in this movie that makes, to me, says he did it. But I think if you just literally had kind of a montage of the trial, which I still don't understand how, because we don't see the jury actually give verdict. You know, the verdict. We literally just have the judge reading it, you know, giving his verdict, which feels weird for a capital case. But it gets it going. It's quick, but I think it starts it off a little strange compared to the rest of the film.
I would have just started with the bus driving into Shawshank.
That would have been completely acceptable too. Yeah.
Because, you know, that's how the Family Guy segment opens.
it doesn't do anything. The first 5 minutes of this movie doesn't really do anything compared to, you know, for the rest of it.
It's a false Other start because it also leads you to believe that the whole movie is going to be about like uncovering the mystery of if he actually did it.
Yeah, the like, fugitive.
Yeah. Or like, was he going to have like a lawyer that regularly meets him in prison? Yeah. I think it's a bit of a misdirect.
The only thing it does is make it clear that this movie can last for decades and nobody ages.
Well, because this starts in 1947.
Yeah, I have words about that as we get into it. But the prosecutor says this was all about revenge as he unloaded all the bullets right into both victims twice each. And then we cut to good old Red, played by Morgan Freeman, who swears he's been rehabilitated and he's a different man. Okay, so Morgan Freeman was nominated not for Best Supporting Actor. He was nominated for Best Actor for this. Sorry, Tim Robbins. And apparently Freeman was not very nice on the set. I don't really think he trusted Darabont. At one point, when Andy is introducing himself to him and he asks for a rock hammer later, you notice Morgan Freeman's playing catch. I think Darabont thought he might have been Stanley Kubrick or something, because he made them do that take something like 70 times. And the next day, Morgan Freeman showed up with a sling. And he was not happy with how that scene played out. I think Morgan Freeman's pretty good in this. I do have issues with the narration, though. I know this is what Morgan Freeman became known for. He would do March of the Penguins years later. I like the character of Red a lot. And by the way, as he makes a joke about later, this is a white character in that book with red hair. So they went a different route with that. I think Morgan Freeman works really well in this role. I just don't like the narration.
Well, I don't like the narration because it tells you everything you need to feel. It's purposefully manipulative, which is also weird to do in a movie that's trying to be ambiguous about did this guy actually kill his wife, which also is very strange. But the counter to that is then if you remove the narrations, then why don't you just make Andy the main character? Like, I think one of the flaws I have with this movie is I don't think the whole dual protagonist aspect really works. I think it's a juggling act that they try to balance out evenly, and it never 100% works. I don't know if it's just me because I love him. I wish Clint Eastwood played this character, not just because it would have been a nod to Escape from Alcatraz, but what does work is this plays off of, I think, making Red black reflected a lot of black men in prisons who had no interest in reintegrating to society because they became institutionalized. In a weird way, there was more freedom there than it was in the real world if you were a black man.
Adam, how do you feel about Morgan Freeman here?
Freaking as good as it gets. Oh, wait, damn, different movie. I think he's superb. You forget it's not his movie. And you could change your perspective a little bit and make it his movie, because as the narrator, that's usually who your movie is about. And this thing goes back and forth with that a little bit, and I do have an issue with it that way. But I think he's superb. I think without him in it, I don't know if this works the same way if you're going to have him narrate the whole thing. I do think Eastwood would be maybe the only other person that I would listen to narrate this, though I don't know if maybe he would be able to talk about Andy wallowing through 500 yards of shit, and I would believe it the same way. Yeah, this is classic for a reason. It's been parodied a million times because of it, but this is an amazing performance by Mr. Freeman.
Well, the problem also, I think the wrong person got nominated.
You think Tim Robbins should have been nominated?
I don't think either. Like, I think they're both good, but I don't think it's like the best performance from either of them. Now, I know in the case of Morgan Freeman, that's a high bar because he's given some really good performances, and the same for Tim Robbins. But I don't see any like Oscar type of moments from either of them. I think a lot of it is because of what they're given and how Darabont accentuates it with like I think the music plays a big factor. I think Deakins, the way he frames some of the scenes, really adds to like the power of it. But a lot of it, I don't strictly attribute to the acting. I think there's someone in here in the supporting aspect who should have been nominated and wasn't. And in hindsight, it's kind of shocking because the category is tailor-made for older actors in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
That I'm almost baffled a particular person wasn't nominated.
We learned that Red has been denied. And by the way, this mugshot that we see, cameo from Morgan Freeman's son, who is also here as one of the prisoners as well. So nice little bit of cameo there. And you wouldn't notice it. It looks exactly like his father here. So we mentioned the voiceover being overpowering. Speaking of overpowering, that would lead me to the score of this movie. Now, God, I was kind of scared to review this movie because there's so many parts of it that I'm going to kind of lambast. And this score is one of the most loved scores in history. And as people who listen to this podcast know, I love musical scores. I think Thomas Newman has done a few good scores. I don't think this is one of them. I think every time his score comes on, it's a downturn. I don't get brought in by this score at all.
I think it fits this movie. I think it complements it. I don't get any swell, rising good vibes because this isn't that movie. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing in here where you got a cheer for moment, really. So I think it fits this. I mean, this movie is a drama. This is your grandparents' kind of movie, you know, when you think about it. And I think the score fits that very complimentary.
Garrett, I love you because you and I share the exact same brain patterns here, because I find the score, when it's not being kind of morose, it's way too overbearing in certain aspects. I think it is one of the most emotionally manipulative scores in a mainstream movie, maybe in the history of cinema. And a lot of times, I think it's overcompensating, which I will say about Darabont's direction as well. I think a lot of this movie is the Hollywoodization of the prison drama. There are aspects that I think are very sharply and correctly downtrodden and oppressive, both from like the guards to the warden to just prison life in general. But a lot of it also feels very schmaltzy and sentimental, especially at a time in the 40s and through the 60s where prison life was a lot worse than this. When you look at the conditions, when you look at the lack of care inmates receive, this is a lot more sanitized than it actually was. And it starts off a lot rawer, and then it gets less and less authentic, which I have a problem with as well.
Yeah, the sisters do a lot more damage in the book than they do here. And I think he meant to do that because I think he wanted to show the overpowering nature of this prison in the beginning. And then he does just kind of refrain from that.
Well, it's not just that, but like you see, we'll talk about a little bit, like you have Clancy Brown openly basically beat an inmate to death. You have the warden and how he uses religion and Christianity to be oppressive, to prison rape, which is check the box. That's in basically almost every prison movie for that matter. But just the living conditions were a lot worse than they're depicted here. Like I said, I feel like it gets more commercialized as it goes on. It doesn't feel as authentic as, you know, look at the contemporaries like Bad Boys. Mm-hmm. Prison life is horrible in that movie, mm-hmm. Among other ones. And the movie, for me, plays all too often as a crowd pleaser and not always is as in sync with the drama and the harshness that it should be. Which I feel that way about a lot of Darabont's work. I swear to God, this and The Green Mile, sometimes I can't distinguish between the two if you show me a particular scene.
Red says that Andy Dufresne came to him in 1949 in order to smuggle Rita Hayworth into the prison for him. That was the start of things. So we have some big swooping shots of this prison, and we're hearing that Andy came to this prison in 1949 for murdering his wife and the guy she was banging. And then we see the bus unload more prisoners, and Matt, I'm kind of with you, man. Why not start it here?
Right, because the movie buries the lead by showing him get sentenced, and it'd be interesting if you found out, why is this guy in prison? Because he's clearly not violent. He's very reserved throughout most of the movie, too. Like Tim Robbins purposefully underplays it to be very kind of nebbish and elusive. But the problem is that also makes it harder for me to root for him in a lot of ways. Like, his actions drive the character more than the performance does.
All right, so let's get to Tim Robbins as Andy Dufresne. Would it have hurt to have him stumble at least once during the course of this film? A big problem I have with Dufresne is he doesn't do much wrong in this, which would kind of make him more of a Jesus parable, and that would kind of make this a fable.
Yeah, I think that has to do with Tim Robbins' performance, which I think he's fine at best in this. To me, almost the most boring person in this film is its supposed lead. I think Andy Dufresne is along for the ride, but I don't think Tim Robbins changes performance much from the beginning to the end. I don't think he does more than just play it as even keel as possible. And to get into that character is a problem for me. I think I like everything going on around much more when I'm watching it. He's there.
Yeah, I feel like he's too even keeled through a lot of this. Even when he's at his lowest, he doesn't show enough emotion for me to fully believe that. I almost need that scene where he like has a mental breakdown, but because he's like Rocky. He gets knocked down and gets back up without any scars. Like they put him in the hole multiple times. He gets beaten up, he gets raped, but I never feel like he's browbeaten enough to where his like escape feels like this climactic catharsis for him. And instead, I'm just like, okay, why is this moment your breaking point that you're leaving? You've been here for that long. I mean, we'll talk about that when we get later on in the film. But I think there's so many other actors. Like when I read some of the names, now age is part of a factor for this. But like Darabont looked at Gene Hackman. He looked at Robert Duvall. He looked at Paul Newman. Now, I think all of them would have been a little too old just based on what Andy needs to be for how long he's in prison. But Tom Hanks was considered, which is ironic because of The Green Mile. I think he would have been great in this, but Forrest Gump, I'm sure took a lot of his time. Kevin Costner passed on it because of Waterworld. Granted, I do think Tim Robbins is a better actor than Kevin Costner. But when I read names like Johnny Depp and Nicolas Cage, I really would have liked to see either of them.
I do think the issue is because we never see it out of Andy. Like, even if we had read, I mean, the movie, with him being the narrator, that means it's all from his perspective. But at least if we even had him talking about the night that I saw Andy break down is not something I can explain. Oh, it's there, but it's not there. But we never see Dufresne change from the moment he walks in.
Yeah, and that works for Red because he's a character who refuses to change. He likes prison life, but by having Andy as the other character, he should be a stark contrast. And I get it. I don't feel like he is.
And from Red, I feel like everything he's doing is to try to... I feel like for 20 years, he's put it on to try to get out. And I think once he's convinced that he can't, that's it. He's got his walls up. He's going to be a blank canvas.
It's not that Tim Robbins is a bad actor. That's a weird thing. Like, he's... It's just, like, you look at stuff like The Player and The Hudsucker Proxy and Bull Durham. That's not the performance you get here. And you see him be more reserved in, like, Mystic River. But I want that performance to be more like this, where he has a breaking point in that movie because of what he's been through. Not to spoil that movie, which I... It's one of those movies, people, you will watch it once and you will never watch it again because it's so goddamn depressing.
Yep.
He's so fucking good in that movie. Jacob's Ladder, he's great in that. But Jacob's Ladder also benefits from the unreliability. And it's not steeped in reality. It's purposefully psychological. And maybe this would have worked better if we're questioning Andy's mental state because Red is the one who's trying to perceive it to the audience.
So Red's first impression of Andy is that he's, quote, a tall drink of water.
I mean, that's true. He does tower over everybody else.
They're brought in as we meet Norton the Warden, as rule number one is no blasphemy. Now, Norton is interesting. It's a bit of condensing by Darabont, because in the book, Andy goes through two or three different wardens. I do think it was a good decision by Darabont to keep it one warden the entire movie.
For the purpose of condensing characters, I think this works. But like a lot of King antagonists, he's kind of one note. He's just pious, he's money hungry, and he doesn't really evolve beyond that. Even by this point, I am sick of King yelling at people that Christianity is bad and hypocritic. As much as I may agree with aspects of it, I think in this one it's a bit much.
Wait till we get to Darabont's The Mist.
Or The Green Mile, for that matter, because there's a lot of allegories in that, because holy shit.
Oh yeah, I just finished that book, and my God. Adam, do you feel that was a good bit of condensation?
I do. I think changing him out would have been... I think I would understand it from a story standpoint, because from what I understand, shocker everybody, I haven't read this. From what I understand, this entire book is about kind of the passage of time. So on the page, I get that that's how you would do it. I'll say though, at least this is the one person in this movie who actually ages, you know?
Hey, Dufresne gets some gray temples later on.
The fuck he does.
Like, We might as well have Shoot playing, because the most they do is have Salt and Pepper and Morgan Freeman's beard.
Guys.
Or his hair, excuse me.
Guys, how distracting would it have been? I mean, how many times have we made fun of old age makeup on this podcast? It would have been distracting to put these guys in these fucking makeup. I have no issues with that.
Well, you can do it if you maybe you cast them younger. Like, yeah, you cast younger actors and then, you know, make them like middle age, or because it's like, fable-esque, you could cast multiple two different actors to play these guys, given how far in advance we go. Like, as long as you convincingly sell it and I feel like they're playing the same character just older, I will buy it.
Let them go on a bender for the weekend and film them with bags under their eyes. I don't care. But no, it's a problem for me that we're here for decades and they don't age.
And also, facial hair really helps. Like, you look at Harrison Ford in The Fugitive with the beard versus how he normally looked at that time. That did make him look considerably older.
And gray hair makes a big difference. And for all my friends who their hair in their 20s were not the same as their hair in their 40s, come on now.
So you're basically saying go with the Bruce Willis philosophy of just age gracefully. If you look great, so be it. If not, don't try to fight it.
The passage of time, I think, is drawn out very well by us going through each tax season. Each tax season tells us it's a different year. I have no issues with the non-aging of this, but I guess I'm alone on that island.
It just bothers that apparently, like, the Green Mile is here because it apparently slows down your aging, your cellular aging process.
If you didn't tell me they were here for, what is it by the end of this movie? 19 years, 24 years, something like that?
Well, it starts in 47 and he gets out in what, 65?
It's about 30 years.
So it might as well be 5 years. That's just how I feel about it. Look, I'm going to find things to nitpick about this movie because that's what we do, and because I'm going to be lavishly loving so much of this. That's my one I'm going to hit.
So Norton says he believes in two things, discipline and the Bible. Andy is hosed down and taken to a cell as Red just keeps on talking throughout the entire scene. We go to that night as Red recalls how the guys always go fishing as William Sadler's Haywood starts taunting a prisoner who is talking about how he's not supposed to be here, and Clancy Brown's Captain Hadley beats the hell out of him. I do love Clancy Brown in this. We're going to be talking about him again when we get to Pet Sematary 2. I like him in this.
I thought you were going to say we were doing a Highlander retrospective. I didn't know he was in Pet Sematary 2.
Yeah.
What I like is that this isn't the Clancy Brown performance you normally think of with so many things. As much as he's, you know, the toughest screw to ever be, you know, whatever the line is, this isn't Kerrigan. This isn't even Mr. Crab. This is amazingly enough kind of a restrained Clancy Brown, and I think he's really, really good in this.
He's restrained, but you're waiting for that someone to say the wrong thing and he just loses his shit. Because you get the sense this guy is like an inmate so much as touches him or looks at him funny, he will beat them to a pulp, which he basically does here.
Yeah,
I feel like Clancy Brown's the one like constant as far as just showing how awful prison life can be in this movie. Because he's always there for so much of it. Even more, he's like scarier than the warden in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he is.
And on the flip side, I like William Sadler. He's the closest this movie has to any semblance of, like, I don't want to say comic relief. But he's, like, the one who's not treating this all that seriously. Like, he's just like, yeah, I'm here. And I'm going to make the most of my time on this planet by just, you know, acting like it doesn't bother me. Mm-hmm. And apparently he got this from, he did the first episode of Tales from the Crypt, which Darabont and company were heavily involved in. And he just stayed attached to it for a long time.
You know who else is in this? Is the prisoner from that Woman in the Room short that we watched a couple years ago. He's in here as well.
And you got a lot of people that Darabont has regularly worked with, like Jeff DeMunn is the attorney at the beginning. So, like, Darabont's like Sam Raimi, where if he likes you, he will keep using you.
Well, and I think I've mentioned this in the past. I've talked to filmmakers that tell me this. The reason why they bring the same people to different movies is because if you're going to a new film and you're gonna be surrounded by new people, you need somebody to back you at all times. You need somebody as a backbone. And that's a lot of the reason. And Darabont has been out. He has said that I have never been easy to work with. And if I have somebody who can back me, then I will bring them no matter what. So I do like that he is loyal to these people, but it's also for his own protection.
Should have brought more people because clearly Morgan Freeman didn't think much of
it. Exactly.
Which is also weird because Morgan Freeman, people forget this, he didn't start acting until much later in life. He got his big breaks right before this. You look at Driving Miss Daisy, Glory, Unforgiven. Like, he got very lucky.
Hadley then says he better not hear a mouse fart in here before walking away. And Red says, through all of this, Dufresne never made a sound. We cut to the next day as breakfast is picked up and another prisoner gives his food to another prisoner in order to give it to his bird, Jake, who he says he's going to look after until he can fly.
Just gave his food, gave it a maggot. So I guess, I swear to God, some of the people. So I guess the animal right group that was overseeing this film had an issue with the maggot because they made him find a naturally dead maggot. They didn't want him to kill one for this scene. So Darabont said he found one that, you know, had a maggot, waited till it died, and then used it in the scene. And it was like 15 years later, he went, yeah, I killed that fucking maggot.
Haywood brags about a set of cigarettes he got imported, and Andy asked the name of the horse who died. Andy's then asked if anyone has gotten to him yet, and Boggs Diamond says everyone needs friends in here, and he can be a friend to Andy if he needs it. After Andy walks away, he just calls Andy hard to get. Is this prison too sanitized?
Well, I already answered that question. I think for the large part, like, once Boggs gets beaten and crippled, outside of being thrown in the hole, that's like the scariest thing that happens in prison. So I feel like it does lose its teeth after a short period.
Yeah, but I don't think this movie's about prison as much as it is two men becoming lifelong friends. I do think it's a love story between these two. Yeah, I mean, I think The Longest Yard is almost a truer prison story than this one.
We see Andy working in the laundry room as we cut to Red, who says that Andy had a lot on his mind, and the one he said more than two words to was Red himself.
Vagina poop.
We didn't see Andy introduce himself to Red, and Red asked Andy why he did it, and Andy denies doing anything to get him here, and Andy then says that he heard Red can get him things, so he asked for a rock hammer due to him being a rock hound. Red is questioning him and his motives, asking if maybe he wants to plunge the hammer to somebody's skull, but Andy says he has no enemies here, and Red says he better grow eyes in the back of his head due to Boggs taking a liking to him.
this scene where he's there, ask him if he did it and all that, and he goes, don't you know, I'm innocent, just like everybody else here. Him including the just like everybody else here, in the way the film is, to me says that Andy did it.
Oh, so you think that's like a hidden admission of guilt?
Admission? Really?
Because he says he did it. I'm the same as everybody else here. So either they're all innocent, they're all guilty. But he says, I'm innocent just like everybody here.
Then I think that negatively affects me being on his side. Like, he did a crime. If that's true, he did it for justifiable reasons. But then it's hard for me to get sympathy for all the horrible shit that happens to him because he put himself there.
Red says that he'll get the hammer for $10, and if he's caught, he'll never do anything for him again. And Andy asks Red why he's called that, and Red says, maybe it's just because I'm Irish. Nice little joke, because as I mentioned, he's Irish and redheaded in the book.
Like that.
Red then says in his voiceover that he liked Andy from the start. We go inside the laundry room as Red gets his cigarettes and rock hammer. He says that he understood Andy's joke and that it would take 600 years to tunnel out of here using that thing. So of course he won't do it, right?
No, just 19.
Yeah. Andy is then cornered and prison raped as he fights and is then told, good fight. It's better that way.
Squeal for me, piggy.
Right.
I at least appreciate, I'm saying that in quotes, that they cut away from the way so many other films at this time just glorified prison rape in their prison movies. And again, I use that almost, you know, ironically saying glorify, but it's still a staple of every prison. You know, Matt pointed it out, you know, check that box. But at least this one uses it differently and to move the story more than just, you know, have it as a something to focus on.
See, I don't feel like it moves the story, though, because he gets taken out like 10 minutes from now. And we've already established that the guards have no qualms about beating an inmate to death if they look at them the wrong way. So this just feels like an obligatory checkbox.
And the other
so part, much so that James Gandolfini turned this role down.
He did.
Jesus. I didn't think he turned down anything looking at some of his oeuvre.
Well, he ended up beating the hell out of Patricia Arquette. That's
True Romance.
Yeah, that's the role he took instead. But here's the other problem with this whole thing. It's a big problem I have with prison movies in general, is that every single time we see sex depicted in prison movies, it's non-consensual. There is consensual sex done in prisons, and we never see that.
No. And a lot of times, like some of the best prison movies, you don't think of prison rape. Like Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah, that's a good
there's one. I don't think there's any prison rape in that.
I don't think there is either.
And it's been a long time since I've seen it, but that's almost one of the checkboxes one of the landmines they got around.
Mm-hmm. We're hearing how routine prison life is and how Andy would sometimes show up with new bruises. He says that he believes the first 2 years were the worst for Andy. No shit.
You could say he looks like a dead man walking.
Which he would do in the next year.
Yep, he would direct a prison movie next year.
He liked it so much. They then end up getting outdoor detail. So Hadley talks about how his brother just died a millionaire and he's going to be left $35,000 of it. Andy has his eyes on the conversation and not on his mop. So Andy approaches Hadley and says that does he think his wife is going to go behind his back, and if he wants to keep that money, he better just give it to his wife. Hadley says he knows he's the banker who killed his wife, and Andy says he'll help him with the forms if Hadley gives his friends 3 beers. We then see all of them drinking beers at 10 in the morning.
Boy, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, right. See, here's the thing. In the movie, they're all ice cold. In the book, King describes them as lukewarm beer, but it's the best beer they've had because they haven't had it in so long. I don't see how these prisoners can appreciate how this is just beer if it's extra ice cold and not lukewarm. That change just baffled me.
Yeah, and given how like clearly these guards have they treat them like cattle. Mm-hmm. They would go the extra mile to put ice in the beer and all that and treat them like dignified people. That's pretty inauthentic, if you ask me.
Andy's just sitting in the shade with a strange smile on his face, and he says that he gave up drinking, and Red says that he did it to feel normal again. You know what's weird about this is, since I'm the King fan, I think about it in context of when he wrote these stories. King was a huge drinker around this time. I do think this is kind of him kind of talking to his audience, saying he's trying to quit drinking, but he just can't. Maybe that's just me reading too much into it.
No, I think there's a through line there.
I think anytime alcohol is in his books, I think it's a part of himself.
Andy says he's going to teach Red chess, even carve the pieces himself. In order to do this, he'll need some rocks to carve. Red then asks Andy why he did it, and Andy says that he's innocent. So once again, playing that card. Red says that he's in for murder, yet he's not innocent.
Weird that they keep... He keeps asking him.
Yeah.
What leads you to believe there's going to be a point where he tells him, oh, yeah, I actually did it.
You think there's going to be a confession coming. Yeah, I thought the same
thing. Right. Especially because of, like, the oppressive Christian leader, the warden. Like, maybe he treats Red as, like, a confessional and tells him, yeah, I did it, but I feel horrible about it.
We see Andy start carving some chess pieces as he carves on the wall. We'll come back to that. We cut to the prisoners watching Gilda, and Red knows exactly when Hedo Hayworth comes on screen and does that thing with her hair, as he says. Andy says that he wants Red to get him Rita Hayworth. Andy is then jumped again and brought into the room, and he says, just get this over with. Boggs says that he's going to open his fly, and he's going to swallow what he wants him to swallow. Ouch. Andy says the bite reflex can be so hard, and they've had to pry jaws off with a crowbar, and this causes Boggs to not put anything in his mouth, but he did beat him within an inch of his life, causing Andy to spend a month in the infirmary, and Boggs to spend a week in the hole. Boggs then meets up with Hadley, who beats him the hell up, causing Boggs to never walk again and living the rest of his days drinking food through a straw, as Red says.
God, Family Guy has ruined this scene for me.
What did they do with this? I'm scared to ask.
It's like two things never happened again. Boggs never walked again, and Andy's farts never made a sound again.
They do this one so well.
Like it's the Shawshank one of the three, I think it's the funniest.
Oh, they did three versions of it.
Yeah, right? It's called Three Kings.
It's called Three Kings. Oh, you think it's a Christmas episode?
And it's Stand By Me, Misery, and Shawshank.
Jesus.
But and in all three of them, Joe gets crippled because he's in a wheelchair in the show.
The rest of the guys start getting some rocks for chess pieces. Red then finally gets Andy his Rita Hayworth poster. It comes with a note which reads, "No charge. Welcome back." We see Andy reading the Bible as his room gets inspected. The warden comes in and says that he's pleased to see Andy reading the Bible. And then Andy just goes over his favorite passage.
It's just so funny because this came out the same year as Pulp Fiction.
I know.
I was expecting him to say Ezekiel 25:17.
The warden says that he hears Andy is good with numbers, and he explains that he likes shaping rocks. The warden then makes an exception for the Rita Hayworth poster, and we're hearing that Norton just wanted to size Andy up as he offers Andy something more befitting for his education. Andy is getting a tour of the library from Brooks as we see the bird from earlier, The Passions of Time. Now, this is played by James Whitmore, and Matt, I'm assuming this is the guy you were talking about who deserved a nomination.
I would say yes. Because he's the most emotional thing in the movie, like his storyline. And this is the type of role, like, you know, legendary actor, prominent movie, tragic ending. This screams Oscar nomination. Like, this is the kind of role that, given the time, like Jack Lemmon would have played this.
Andy asks why he is now Brooks' assistant. We get to meet Deakins, who says that he's thinking of setting up a trust fund for his kid's education. We didn't see Brooks tell the story of how Deakins actually shook Andy's hand, and he says that he's not making friends, he's just a convicted murderer who's good at finances. Brooks says in no uncertain terms of how all wardens who've come here are tight with funds, and then we cut to Andy asking the warden for more funds, and Andy suggests he write the state senate one a week asking for funds, and the warden says to go ahead, he'll even mail them for him. We're hearing that Andy got no answers, but he is doing all their taxes. So, Adam, you're watching this for the first time last year. What are you thinking at this point? You know that Andy's going to eventually get out, but what are you feeling when you're seeing how he's filing all these taxes and things?
And that is a crazy thing. Like, I know the end of it. I know this, you know, the crawling through sewer. Like, I know that stuff. I know the scene of him emerging because I know pop culture. The rest of this, I'm going to tell you, the first time I watched it and this time, I stopped, like, my notes on this movie stop when we get to the outdoor detail because I'm just watching the movie. I'm just enamored with it. I think the story being told, I think the way it's being told are so encompassing, so fascinating that I'm drawn in. Like, I just forget I'm watching a movie. I'm just watching this happen. And I fucking love it.
So the weird thing is, I think this is a very skillfully made movie as far as the transitions outside of the lack of aging, which is a more of a nitpick. But I think one of the problems with the way this story is structured by expanding it is the movie's really a series of vignettes, almost like episodes of a TV show. This week it's the Tommy episode. This week it's the Brooks episode. And because of that, some are, I think, vastly better than others and kind of have to get through the ones you don't especially care for. Like this whole thing with him doing the taxes and getting sort of in bed with the warden. It's also only here to, because this movie does a lot of not so subtle foreshadowing. It's only here to set up where the money goes to at the end, which yes. I also think is a stretch because nobody caught this. It does this for damn near 20 years.
Matt, had you seen the movie before you read the book, or did you read the book before you watched the movie?
I read the book first and then saw the movie. And obviously looking at the runtime, I knew they were going to take some liberties. I mean, mm-hmm. How could you not? Because the one thing about this, it's what, 2 hours 20?
Yep.
Close to. It's not like Stand By Me, which is 90 minutes. or close to it. Like this one, you know, this and At Pupil, they really extend.
Is there anything that they really added, or is everything just kind of stretched out a little bit?
Well, I'll tell you something they changed. What they changed is Andy collects all this dirty money in this movie, right? And that's how he's going to end up living when he gets out. In the book, he invests it. And I think that's an interesting bit of changing.
Well, the big thing is Red's in prison in the novella because he staged a car accident.
I read that he, you know, supposedly killed his wife for the insurance money because he's a gambler, which is funny because as long as this is, that's cut out.
Yeah, and the timeline's different. In the book, Andy first gets there in 48 and he gets out in 77. Like it's 30 years. This one, it's closer to 20. They changed the pseudonym that he, like, it's Randall Stevens in this. In the book, in the novella, I think it's Peter Stevens. But most of the beats are here. Like the Rita Hayworth poster, the Boggs and the sisters, the inheritance with Hadley, all that's here. The one, almost everything is translated. It's more of like an extension of every.
It's just letting everything breathe.
Yeah, although the Brooks subplot is not a huge part of the novella.
I heard that's just a paragraph. So it's funny that they cut it down when it's a novella and you would think they'd be expanding it.
Red says by being Andy's assistant, it actually got him out of the shops. And we then cut to Brooks, who's holding a knife to Hayward's throat, and Andy tries talking him out of it, which he does, and Hayward says that Brooks' parole came through. Red says that here, Brooks is important. Out in the real world, he's nothing. He then goes over what institutionalized means as we cut to Brooks saying goodbye to Jake, freeing him in the process. And then we cut to him being let out and riding a bus. We're hearing a letter he wrote about how fast things are moving and that the world got itself in one big damn hurry. And Matt, to you, this is the emotional crux of the movie, correct?
Yeah, this is a guy who's been in prison 50 years. And you think about the turn of the century when he was incarcerated to the 50s when he gets out. Our country went through two world wars, technology, like the invention of the automobile, like it's like waking up on Mars for all intents and purposes. And yeah. I think they sell in just a very short time, like how difficult it is for him to adjust just bagging groceries at the store and how he just can't cope. Like, I think this is a very shining a spotlight also on how we rehabilitate former inmates with halfway houses. And in particular, you're seeing that, you know, old white man. It's also kind of foreshadowing, like, this is why Red does not want to get out. Because he knows, not only is he incapable of doing it, but the world, or especially in America, they would purposely put obstacles in front of him as a black man to make this even harder of a thing to adjust to.
Brooks says that he has a job bagging groceries and he can't keep up. And we see him go to the park and feed the birds, hoping Jake will come by and say hello. He says he's having trouble sleeping at night and sometimes it takes him a while to realize where he is. He says he doesn't like being here and he's tired of being afraid all the time. He's decided not to stay as he stands on the desk and kills himself. God, this was depressing. In the book, he pretty much just withers away in an old folks home. Yeah. Adam, as you described, yeah, that is just in a paragraph where it goes over it. Here, Darabont decided to expand on that. And I think Matt hit it perfect. This is Red's biggest fear, is ending up like this.
I think this scene it's beautiful. And I mean that in every horrifying way. This is so well done. It is told so well. It is acted so well. To Matt's point, that this wasn't a nominee, more so a win, is shameful of the Academy. I'll say that 32 years later. This is just brilliant storytelling and filmmaking. Like, the way that this Brooks part is done, is told, is wonderful and wonderfully horrible, but it is just great filmmaking. The way that his carving Brooks pays back later is fantastic. I'm sitting and I'm watching this and it's, you know, it gets all my emotions. It's up, it's down. It's, you know, because you want him to succeed, then you realize he's not going to. And then you see what happens and is it better to die as a free man? And was he free when he was released or was he more free in prison? It's heartbreaking and it's fucking great storytelling.
It's also a smart directing advice or trick because his narration, we find out, is a letter that they're reading.
Red says that he should have died in here, not out there. Andy then sees that there are letters addressed to him, and we hear that the state has allocated some funds, as well as a whole new set of used books.
Just to shut him up.
Just to shut him up, yeah. Andy says it only took 6 years. We didn't see Andy put on a record, and God, do I hate scenes like this. Let's pretend opera or classical music is one big magic potion that brings everyone together. Fuck this. This was added by Darabont. I hate this so much. This fucking sound system wouldn't be this big in the goddamn 50s. Oh my god, do I hate this.
So you would have preferred Hollaback Girl by Gwen Stefani? Like our Family Guy?
I wouldn't have preferred anything in this. I would have preferred this scene to be fucking cut.
This is the wrong kind of schmaltz, and this goes too far into fucking fantasy for me. They put him in solitary confinement, but also the fact that like it takes them forever to break down the door. I hate this whole scene.
Let me guess. Adam's going to love it. Go ahead, Adam. Hit praise on it. Go ahead.
Damn. If you haven't heard music in a year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and that's what I'm assuming. There's nothing played here for these people. This would be a drop of water in a desert. So it wouldn't even matter the kind of music that it is.
And I'd still say die of thirst.
And they would not hear it this fucking proclaimed in the speakers.
So I think he's giving something to these people, and I think they would all rally around hearing music for the first time in who knows how long.
I did like the guy reading Archie comics in the John. I thought that was funny. And then Red is right on when he says some things are just better left unsaid.
Which is funny coming from a Morgan Freeman narration.
We see that the warden's pissed and insists that Andy open the door, and Andy just turns it up. And then we see Andy go to lunch, and we hear that he was just let out of the hole. Andy says, we need music so that we don't forget that there are places in the world that aren't made of stone.
Exactly. Thank you, Andy.
Red said
that. Play Queens of the Stone Age.
Nice 90s reference, Matt. I'm proud of you for that one. Red says that hope is a dangerous thing, and it can drive a man insane. We cut to
Rebellions are built on hope.
Yeah. We cut to Red going for another evaluation, saying he served.
That was Castle Rock's mantra for the Oscar campaign. Hope is a dangerous thing.
Right.
Because I guarantee you, they watched Forrest Gump and went, oh, we're so fucked.
Yeah. We cut to Red going for yet another evaluation, saying that he served 30 years of a life sentence. And again, Red says that he's a changed man and he's absolutely rehabilitated. But again, he's denied. We then see Andy give Red a little parole rejection present, that of a harmonica. However, Red says, as nice as it is, he's not going to play it right now.
Especially because it's prison, and think about how he smuggled in that harmonica. I would not put that near my mouth in a million years.
We cut to an inspection as Andy gets the present of a new girl, that of Marilyn Monroe, to celebrate his 10-year anniversary of being there. And we cut to Red playing his harmonica. We're hearing that Andy wrote 2 letters a week instead of one, and Andy is making deals with book clubs, including Count of Monte Cristo by Alexander Dumbass, as he says. We're seeing Hayward listen to Hank Williams, and the warden puts them to work for a bare minimum of expense. The money rolls in as they're providing a valuable community service. We're seeing the warden attempt to be bribed with apple pie, and Andy being in charge of the books. Red expresses concern over how many pies Andy is sticking his fingers in, and Andy says not to worry. He then says he made a person up, and if they start chasing it, they'll be chasing a figment of his imagination. He adds that it took him going to prison to be a good crook.
Well, it's also weird because like you would need to launder money like this. You'd probably need, what, a social security number? You'd need... This is one of those things where the optics, they get around it by, he's a banker, he would know how to do this. Okay, mm-hmm. So we got a wife-killing baker who knows how to embezzle money. Why am I supposed to like this guy?
Yeah. We're hearing the siren goes off as Tommy Williams shows up based on breaking and entering. And guys, you know who this was supposed to be played by?
Brad Pitt.
This was a Brad Pitt role. He ended up leaving because he also did not trust Darabont as a first-time director, and he was starting to get roles based on his Thelma and Louise blow-up, so he backed out of this last minute.
He said, I'll work with Morgan Freeman next year.
Exactly. Let me go work with Anthony Hopkins instead.
No, that's a couple years after.
No, he did Legends of the Fall that same year.
No, I was thinking of Meet Joe Black.
Oh, yeah.
Same composer, isn't it?
Yeah, it is the same composer, yeah. Tommy shows up cocky as hell, and Red says that they liked him immediately. Andy suggests to Tommy that he doesn't seem to be a good thief. Maybe he should try something else, and that everybody is innocent in here, as he says. But not Andy, according to Adam.
I just got to say, at this point, and I'd forgotten when he shows up, I could not believe that they found a way to get a greaser in a Stephen King movie.
I thought of that too.
Absolutely shocking.
And this is 1965. Like, if this is the 50s, I'd at least excuse it. But, you know, we're now in the midst of the hippie culture, and he should be having like a Beatles t-shirt on.
I'm going to be so curious after we watch Stand By Me in a couple of weeks, what you have to say about greasers.
And this character, this plot line is different in the book.
Big time. We're hearing that Tommy has a wife and young child, and he goes to Andy asking for a high school GED. He promises
that's, for the record also, that's the equivalent of saying I'm 2 weeks away from retirement in this type of movie.
Matt, why don't you go into the what this story was supposed to be?
Well, the big difference in the book, he just gets transferred to another prison.
Yes.
He's not shot and killed, but that was done purely for emotional manipulation in the part of this movie.
Yeah, he promises he's not a loser, and Andy says that if they do this, they'll go all the way. But Tommy replies he doesn't read so good. I mean, so well. We're hearing from Ted that Tommy took to the courses very well, and Andy uses this time to just keep going, which he's doing by building a library. We see that a poster of Raquel Welch has now decorated Andy's wall. Tommy has no confidence that he did well. He crinkles the paper and throws it into the trash, but Andy picks it up. And then we cut to Tommy talking to Red about how he felt bad for letting Andy down, and Red tells him that Andy was in for murder. And then we see Tommy get nervous when Red says what he was in for. Next scene is of Tommy saying he knows who killed Andy's wife and child. Andy leaves and tells the warden, who says it's the most amazing story he's ever heard, and accuses Williams of making it up. The warden then gets upset when Andy calls him obtuse, and he tells Andy to not make this fantasy his business, puts Andy in solitary confinement for a month. And we see some debates going on that Andy is innocent, and Tommy gets a letter from the Board of Education, which Red opens, and the message is given to Andy that Tommy passed. So Tommy heads outside and is met by the warden. The warden asks they keep this conversation between them. He offers Tommy a cigarette. He says the right thing to do is sometimes hard to know, and he needs Tommy's help in making there being no shred of doubt that what he said to Andy is true. Once confirmed, the warden steps away, and Tommy is shot dead. And Matt is absolutely right. This was completely different in the book. He was just transferred. Here, Darabont wanted to manipulate, and this is how he gets Tommy out of the story, by shooting him. I don't know. I guess it makes the warden look more evil, but I don't know if that helps.
But he's already been shown as oppressive and pious, so it's like, do we have to put a hat on top of a hat? And doing the whole thing of, oh, by pure happenstance, this fucking guy knows he was in the same cell as the guy who claims to have done the murders. Like, this is way too convenient for me.
From the standpoint of the change, I think it's important and it's better, because I don't see why transferring him would be enough to make Andy make the decisions that he does. I don't think there's enough there. I think killing him and making it clear, just saying he died, but everybody knows what happened, I think it's enough to push Andy, because without that, I just don't think there's enough. But I think it also shows that, you know, that we get Clancy Brown back just to show that he is nothing but, he will follow orders, and you can kind of read it on his face that he may even know that this is messed up, but he's going to be that person that's going to do what he's told no matter what.
We cut to the warden visiting Andy, and he tells him that they shot Tommy trying to escape. He also tells Andy to put it behind them and move on. Norton then threatens to make this the hardest time there's ever been served, and the library will be completely gone. He then gives Andy another month to think about it. We cut to Red sitting down next to Andy, who says his wife would accuse him of being a hard man to know. He says while he didn't pull the trigger, he killed her by driving her away. Red says that it makes him a bad husband, but not a murderer. He says that he was in the path of a tornado. He just didn't expect the storm to last as long as it has. He then tells Andy that he'll be out when his beard is long and white, and Andy says he wants a little place by the Pacific Ocean in Mexico, a warm place with no memory. He's going to open a hotel right on the beach and take his guests fishing. Red says he's been here most of his life, and he feels institutionalized like Brooks was. While he's the guy who can get things done in here, what would he be on the outside? Andy says it comes down to a simple choice, that is to get busy living or get busy dying. Andy tells Red about a big hay field in Buxton, and is where he asked his wife to marry him. He wants Red, if he gets out, to promise him to find that spot and a rock that has no business being there. There's something buried under it that he wants Red to have.
He's banking a lot on him remembering all this shit.
Hold that thought. Red says that Andy is talking funny, and it's said that the fact that he has that cell all to himself might be driving him crazy. All right, so a lot is introduced here, a lot that's going to pay off at the end. Adam, I'll go to you first. How do you feel about this conversation?
I think it goes on too long. I think there's too many specifics that are done here for as important as this needs to be, especially for something that's going to happen much later. I think that it happening after a second month in the hole, I think the I didn't do this, I was in the path of, I think he's gone crazy a little bit. I think it's a little too castle in the sky. Especially the way that it ends at the end. I think there's a different way to do this that makes it a little cleaner and a little better. I think this is a little too castle in the sky, a little too hopeful, a little too pipe dream kind of moment. This is about the only monologue dialogue that I'm like, this is about the only time you didn't edit in a way that I like.
I think it's a very convenient that he's given all this information. He's got to expect him to remember every single detail when Red himself has no interest in getting out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Red should tell him, thanks, but no thanks. You go off and live your clearly delusional fantasy in his mind and, you know, leave me here. So I think there's just a lot of... This is the kind of shorthand I don't care for.
Hayward says Andy asked for a length of rope about 6 feet long, and he gave it to him, and Red says everyone has their breaking point. So at this point, if you haven't read that book, you're thinking that Andy might be committing suicide. Adam, did you ever think that?
No, because I know of the scene of him emerging. Okay. Before I even knew about this movie, I knew that scene. Mm-hmm. So it never crossed my mind. But I also don't really think that this plays up that he's going to do it. I think even if you haven't, I don't think you think he would do it. Maybe the reason is because he's never been shown happy. He's never really shown sad. Andy is the same going in that the same going out. So I don't think there's enough change to the character that I feel he's suicidal.
Andy gives the warden the deposits for the day, and the warden asks Andy to shine his shoes and that it's good having him back as the place wasn't the same without him. We cut to Andy shining the warden's shoes, and then he's led back to his cell, and we see him pull the rope out after the lights are put off. Red says that he's never had a night as long as that night, as thunder is going on outside. So we cut to the next morning, as the cells are opened, and we hear that Dufresne is missing from his cell. When they get there, they see that Andy is missing, and the warden sees that Andy actually put his old shoes in the box instead of the ones that were shined. The warden hears that Andy is gone, and Norton says he wants Andy found. He then asks Red if he's seen Andy, and Red assures him that Andy didn't say a word about where he thinks he is. Norton interrogates the Raquel Welch poster, which I actually kind of laughed at. He then throws a rock right through the poster, and they see that the hole is perfectly round. Which, by the way, Stephen King, as you would imagine, had a lot of great things to say about this movie. He loves this adaptation of his work. But the only thing he really had a big problem with is how fucking perfectly round this hole is.
Oh, yeah. It's like a Warner Brothers cartoon level. It's perfectly symmetrical. And I'm sorry, Tim Robbins is not Tom Cruise. This hole would fit Tom Cruise.
I was shocked it happened at this point because I'm like, wait a minute. I know this movie's, you know, what, like 215, 220. I'm like, what the hell are we going to do for the next 30 to 40 minutes? There's some movie after this reveal, and I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good reveal. I'm a little surprised they didn't push harder on Red. Yeah. Because it's shown that they're not good people. So for Warden and for them not to beat him up a little bit, I feel is a little out of character. They wouldn't just take him at his word.
Right.
But, you know, this reveal is pretty good.
Or they would have killed Haywood.
Yeah.
We see that the shirt is on and all they found is a bar of soap, prison clothes, and a rock hammer. Red recalls that he told Andy he'd be able to tunnel out in 6 years and Andy did it in less than 20.
I love that. I love the way that's done. You know,
we're seeing a montage of how Andy did this. And here's the thing. Everything worked out so perfect for Andy, including the fact that he waited till an exact thunderstorm to hit these porcelain pipes to break them. Like, it's just so fucking happenstance. I hate how ironic and fable-ish this is.
Yeah, this is where, like, I think the last third of this movie becomes almost a fable. How it's shot, how it's depicted. It's so operatic with the fucking music when he gets out. I think this is... Now we're taking a sharp turn into Hollywood filmmaking versus the harshness we kind of got in the first... Probably the first quarter, the first third. And again, Family Guy, has, like, why he chose enchilada night, I will never know.
I only excuse some of the ways it does it because this is Red's telling of the story and I think it's not all perfect, but I also don't think they've set that up well enough throughout the film. Like, I can forgive it its givings because this isn't Andy telling his story, it's Red telling Andy's portion of the story. But yeah, the fact, you know, I'm glad that somehow they got the Weather Channel and he knew there was a storm coming in on the same day that everything else happened.
We're seeing how Andy hid the deposits he put in the safe and how he buffed Norton's shoes before putting them on.
Okay. Tim Robbins is considerably taller than Bob Gunton. That suit fits him perfectly. The shoes fit him perfectly. Oh, my God.
How tall are you, Adam?
On my dating profile or in real life?
What does it say on your license?
5'10".
Okay, so this would be like me wearing one of your suits. It's ridiculous.
No, it'd be him.
Big man in a little coat.
We're then seeing the journey that Andy makes, which of course includes him going through tunnels of shit and waiting for the thunder to hit before pounding the metal loose. Very convenient. But I get so claustrophobic watching the scene of him barreling through these tunnels. I keep expecting him to get stuck because Robin's, as we've mentioned, he's not a small guy. He's my height. So he went through 500 yards of shit, and of course we get the famous shot of him raising his arms in freedom as the rain falls down. Fun fact, Roger Deakins hates this shot. Hates it.
Why?
He says it's just lit too much for him, and I don't know, man. It's
the Blue Man Group might as well be on standby with the kind of fucking blue color palette that's here.
It is a triumphant moment. Not to mention, he's in this water. This isn't clean water that he's in. He's still in sewage, but he's raising his arms up in the rain. It is triumphant. Adam, you must really like this scene.
The problem is this is that scene. I mean, Stella, you've done this for as well as this thing is shot, as amazing moments you get on film, the way that you've done it, you recreated a scene that had been done already. So it's good, it's okay. But you know what really upsets me is Red thinking that 1,500 feet is half a mile. No, it's barely
2,600 feet.
Yeah,
exactly. Thank you. It's a quarter mile. The reason I know this is my train is 700 feet long. So when I have to walk both ends of it, I know I've walked about a quarter mile. So I don't want to do math when I'm watching him do this, no. But that's exactly what popped into my head. I swear to God.
I also think this is false advertising because the poster, that pose, he shot during the day.
Yeah.
And it's at night. Or it's like green. I think that looks better.
It's a weird shot. And I think because, I don't know, maybe watching, ironically enough, movie award telecasts, I think I've seen this shot a dozen times.
Yeah.
So I've seen it so much for a film that didn't win anything. I don't know how it would have been, how it would have played for me if I watched it then. But it's just anticlimactic for me now.
We hear that a man nobody had ever laid eyes on strode into the bank having the proper ID and getting his life started. He took $379,000 of Norton's money. As we're seeing sirens approach the prison.
Norton, that's enough to buy your WrestleMania tickets for this year.
Norton sees the place Andy hit his hammer, which is in the Bible, as the police come to arrest Hadley, and Norton takes a gun and shoots himself before the police can get in. Another change from the book. In the book, he's just arrested. Here, he takes himself out. I guess we did that for cinematic purposes, right, Matt?
Oh, yeah, because they want that shot of him in the chair.
Yeah, exactly.
We did, though, I'll say, I do like, you know, that when Clancy Brown is taken, he's still stoic. You don't get anything. But you have Red talking about, you know, I hear that he cried like a little girl.
Red gets a, okay, so let's get to the Return of the King type ending here.
Oh, for God's sake.
Red gets a postcard in the mail, and he laughs at where it's from, as Andy Dufresne was headed exactly where he said he'd go, to the Pacific. Stories of Andy move through the prison, as Red says some birds aren't meant to be imprisoned as their feathers are too colorful. He says that he misses Andy. We're seeing that after going through the same process we've seen at least a couple times before, Red has finally been granted parole.
Before it gets here, I like that we get a couple minutes of everybody telling stories, almost like Andy has just become a fable in Shawshank. You know, there's something nice about how he's a legend. He just disappeared.
We cut to Red leaving the prison. Now in the... Okay, so let's get to this. In the book, it just ends on Red on a bus being hopeful. That's it. It needs to be said, that's where Darabont wanted this to end. He didn't have too many fights with the studio on this, but one thing they insisted on is what we get, which is Red finds the rock along with the money inside and a letter, and yes, he finds Andy. Why not just leave with him being hopeful? Why do we have to have the scene of them finding each other? How did he find him? Matt's completely right. This is all complete happenstance that Red even finds this fucking rock. It's just too fucking convenient. And even in fable circumstances, I can't go with this ending.
I feel like I kind of said my piece already as far as everything is way too convenient for its own good. And it's done because audiences are stupid. They don't want ambiguity. They don't want, you know, optimism. They want clear, definitive, happy ending, because this movie has transcended into being a fable. Like, this might as well be something that ends, the final shot is someone literally closing a book and it says the end with Frank Capra's font in the background. I think it's way too much. I wish they ended it on the "so was Red" that he carved into the wall, and you see him getting on the bus and that's it. I didn't need to see the reunion, because the movie's built on hope. Like, that's the theme of the movie. And it's the hope that he will see him again. I don't need to see the definitive proof.
When you're told that it's the hope that'll kill you, I think you could have ended with Red getting on the bus, sitting on the other side so he's not driving this time, and just looking out as the bus drives off, and he's like, I hope I can find my friend. Boom, credits. One, I don't know how you find that wall. I don't know how it's not been knocked down in 20-something years. So Andy hid this money before he went to jail, and I guess interest rate being what they were, it's amazing that he's got 50s, because that would have been a ridiculous amount of money before he got put into prison. The tree still stands. That rock does not look different enough from the other rocks that he would have seen it. I understand it's obsidian. I know what it is. The way that it's shot, it doesn't look any different. It's a little too much. But even when he finds Andy and the camera pans back, he doesn't have a dock for the boat. There's not a hotel there. There's not, you know, the rest of it. It just goes a little too much. Look, it's a romantic ending. And you could have another movie, and if it's a man and a woman, Hollywood would absolutely be okay with it. But to me, this is two friends who fell in love in prison, and they're going to have their happy ending together. But it stretches credibility, even for a Stephen King property.
Another debate that Darabont and Freeman had was about the very end of this movie. And Darabont wanted Red to play the harmonica that Andy gave him to kind of give indication of where he was and Andy to find him. And Freeman just flat out said, fuck no, and refused to do that, which I think was the better choice, as if this wasn't
right. With Morgan Freeman talking all that shit, he should have been like, all right, you get in the director's chair, you go make a fucking movie.
Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give The Shawshank Redemption? Adam, go ahead, sir.
All right, well, you know, you guys know how I am about Stephen King, so buckle up, sunshine. I can't believe it took me till I was a grown adult to see this movie, but I think I'm glad I did, because I can appreciate what this thing does. This is just storytelling. That's it. I don't know if this movie has an agenda it really needs to tell you. It's a story about the passage of time with two people who didn't know each other from different circumstances. They get brought together, that form a friendship, form a brotherhood and love, and find themselves on the outside later on. When you look at it that way, this thing's pretty damn special. Look, there's a lot of things that happen. There are some amazing performances. They don't all get recognized the way that they, you know, should. From the Warden Norton, from Hadley, and we mentioned him a little bit, but William Sadler as Haywood is pretty damn spectacular in this. Like, he breaks up the monotony when it needs to be. James Whitmore as Brooks is unheralded, but man, he plays an emotional beat that just hits you where you need to. This thing is written extremely well. It takes some liberties with things you just have to go with. It is directed, I think, extremely, extremely well. The acting is superb from most of the performances that are given are really well. I mean, Tim Robbins, I've, you know, kind of beat him up a little bit on this. I think his performance is what he was given to do. So I think he's good. My problem is it just doesn't change. But this thing rides on the back of Morgan Freeman, not just his narration, but his acting. And his performance is superb. I love what this thing does. Now, when this movie is on, if it's on TV, scrolling through, I'll sit and watch it. I think it's an immensely watchable film that you could just kind of pop into anytime. You could watch it for its entire length, or you could watch it for a little bit and be perfectly okay with it. It is a daytime drama movie that, for me, I can enjoy what it does. I hate it because it feels insulting, but it's one of those grown-up pictures that you can just enjoy. You can show it to almost everybody, and it feels welcoming that way. I think this is a great piece of filmmaking that doesn't really stray too far, and because of that, doesn't have many pitfalls. It's great. I will say it is absolutely great. Shawshank is a 9 on 10 for me. I didn't think you would ever get me to give an extremely high score to a Stephen King film, but holy shit, is this thing damn near perfect. I love this film.
Wow. Okay. Oh God,
because I was getting depressed for a while.
All right, Matt, go ahead, sir.
Well, I guess when you have a movie that is as hyped as this is, I mean, it's the number one movie in IMDb, for goodness sake, and been seen in more televisions than American Idol, I guess it's only natural to be one of those people in my case that's a little bit, not disappointed, but I think there's an ideology with this movie and how it's told that I don't always conform to as a moviegoer, and that's being clearly manipulated. Because that's what this is. This is a masterpiece in manipulation. When you look at the fable-esque way the story's told, the way the music accentuates the key scenes, the cinematography, the dialogue, like it's all here to get you to feel a very specific way. And that's all well and good in most circumstances. This is a handsome production in every aspect. Production design, the cinematography, I think it's directed very well. But at the end of the day, it just doesn't move me in the way that it's clearly worked for so many other people. Like, I look at this movie like a painting that I go to the Chicago Museum of Art to see, where I admire the craftsmanship and the work that went into it, but it doesn't emotionally resonate with me in the way that it clearly does for some other people. Maybe it's just me being a jaded asshole, which wouldn't be the first time I've been called that, but in the pantheon of King adaptations, this is one of the most well-regarded, and like I said, I think it's a beautiful movie to look at, and clearly they put in the work. This is a labor of love, but I would have liked a little bit more harshness and a little bit more of a clear tunnel, like the one he crawls through at the end, of a vision as far as who am I supposed to be 100% on board with as the main character. And like I said, I think the shift into a more sentimental type of storytelling in the third act really rubs me the wrong way, because I don't feel like it's 100% in lockstep with what we got for the first portion of the movie. And being that it's clearly an expansion of pre-existing material, I think aspects in the story are, some are much stronger than others. And you're going to get that with an adaptation of this extent. But I'm not going to give it a terrible score. I just don't think this is one of those movies that, I don't like to use the overrated word, but for me, this is one of the ones where I get why so many people love it, but in my personal cinematic portfolio, it's nowhere near one of my favorites. But it's well made, and I'm going to give it a strong 7.
Boy, Matt, there are some podcasts where you and I just clash over every single little thing, and there's very rare ones where you and I see eye to eye on everything. And
well, it's hard for me to see eye to eye with you.
There are chairs, and I am completely locked up with every single thing you just said. I think one of the things, I used to be more harsh on this, because my whole thing, and I mentioned it earlier, about this movie that I always bumped up against, is the fact that Andy's just too perfect a character. He never stumbles along his way. You never feel like his endgame is in question. He never changes expression. And I get that's what Tim Robbins was told to do, and he does it well. However, I cannot go with a character that doesn't have things that make him stumble and make me want to root for him. I don't want to root for Andy. I think at no point, while I don't think he's guilty like Adam does, I don't see him ever failing. And that's a problem for me. But in rewatching it in the years since, I even had a college report that a guy in our group insisted on doing, and I kind of went with just to go with it. And at that time, I found it to be, when I looked at it as more of a fable told from Red's point of view, I could go more with it than I did before. However, the beginning scene changes that whole perspective. But the movie is very well made, and I have to give props to Frank Darabont for trusting his own vision, trusting his instincts, literally betting on himself. And I have to give Rob Reiner a shit ton of credit for swallowing his pride and say, go make your movie. And once it was done, he said, congratulations. There's a lot about the backstory and the making of this that I love, but I don't love the movie. But I am with Matt, where I have a 7 written down as well, because I cannot deny the great filmmaking going on here and the effort being put in by all involved. But that being said, I don't think it's going to land. It might land in my top 10, but it's definitely not going to land in my top 5 of favorite King adaptations. So 7 out of 10 for The Shawshank Redemption. Guys, this thing's released, doesn't do very well, but Stephen King himself, as you can imagine, heaped a lot of praise on this movie, to the point where he never cashed the $5,000 check that Frank Darabont gave him to get the rights to this movie. In fact, he sent it back to Darabont framed with a note on it that said, to Frank, in case you need bail money, love, Steve. So I thought that's kind of amazing that even King can see the effort that went into this and rewarded that.
I don't know. I might have to change my mind, because Stephen King says this is his favorite, and I think I may have just broken the Polymarket market by me being the highest score on a King film of us discussing it. So I may need to rethink this.
Well, I think the high mark from him is probably in a couple of weeks. But yeah, that does it for Shawshank Redemption. And as much praise and as much good things that came out of the making of this movie, I think after next week's review, I may need a shower. Next week, we are talking about Apt Pupil, a movie that The story could not be more dark. It is a complete wreck of a story when it comes to what happens in it, where a Nazi befriends a boy and the boy just kind of manipulates him into turning him into what he eventually becomes at the end of that story. There are so many things to get into with that story, but a big story also has to do with the making of that movie, done by the canceled Bryan Singer, who, yes, we are going to talk about a movie that he does that does not involve people flying around in tights. Oh boy. Next week could be a dirty review. Matt, what are you expecting when we talk about Apt Pupil next week?
I haven't seen it in so long. It's one of the things where I think it's also unfortunate that this is in the same anthology as the film, not just the book, but you have Stand By Me and Shawshank Redemption, two pillars of cinema for a lot of people, that this one gets forgotten about. It didn't get the critical reception of either. Box office, it did about as well as Shawshank did.
Yeah.
All things being as they are. And honestly, outside of, you know, the thing that's lived on from this movie is Sir Ian McKellen and how he became much more of a household name after this, because, you know, the star of this movie, of Apt Pupil, sadly passed, and certainly he had a lot of promise for his career. But I'm curious to go back and watch this, but I'm hesitant because of the world we live in now, not just the allegations that happened on this production, but with the way politics are and youth indoctrination, there's a lot there to talk about, and it's not, clearly King wrote it with a lot of anger. I was clearly making a point, but I'm curious to go back and watch it. I might even read the novella again since I'll have some time, because that's the one of the four I remember the least as far as like changes. So we'll see.
All right, Adam, you have proclaimed of these three movies, this was the one you had seen before we started this goddamn podcast. And how I didn't strangle you at that time, I have no idea. But next week, you are going to revisit Apt Pupil. You did see it in theaters. What are you expecting when we review Apt Pupil next week?
Yep, you're right. Not only did I see it, I saw it in theaters. And I wanted to see it in theaters because I remember seeing the trailer, hearing about it. And not that I was like, ooh, yay, good Nazi movie. But it was the kind of story and the kind of movie that I was interested in seeing from a quote-unquote film, you know, type of thing. So I was really interested to see it in theaters. I did see it in theaters. I remember having some pretty strong thoughts then, and I've only seen it once since, and that was a very long time ago. So I'm quite interested to go back and see it. I think hopefully we can keep, you know, a little less Family Guy out of it, but there's going to be a few. But there's been a lot of things that have happened and occurred with the people involved in that movie. So there will be some of that discussion, but I'm very interested to go back and see if I can still find some of that storytelling that made me want to see it then. Because if it wasn't for this, I don't know if I'd go back to it. So I'm hoping I could get back there.
And Matt, I would recommend you do read that story, because there are things I'm going to bring up during the course of that review that I cannot wait to get into, specifically the ending of that story. But we'll talk about all that next week. But until next week, when we review Apt Pupil, get busy living or get busy podcasting. Thank you, boys.
We forget that there are places in the world that aren't made out of stone, that there's something inside that they can't get to, that they can't touch. It's yours.
What are you talking about?
Hope.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
And for the briefest of moments, every last man at Shawshank felt free.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
And still, it wasn't enough for Himmler.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, the films featuring the team-up of Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio, the ongoing Marvel films, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Exorcist films, the Jaws franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Megan films, the Black Phone films, and so much more.
Pleased to see you reading this.
And if you would like to follow Garrett as he reads and review Stephen King's books in publication order, find and friend his profile on the Goodreads app.
If you ever get out of here, do me a favor.
Sure, Ed. Anything.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Boy, be careful. You play with fire.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
I'm not ashamed to say that I could use a drink about now. Ooh.
A Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Hobby of mine.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
In a place like that, I could use a man that knows how to get things.
Scheduling done by Matt.
Friends a long time, so I know I'm as good as anybody.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I think I just turned my Fruit of the Looms into a fudge factory.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production, copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
Skin it.
I'll see ya. I see you first.
As a consolation prize, Rob Reiner went and did an adaptation. I'm sorry. Oh, I just had a Nutri-Grain bar got stuck in my throat. Around this time,
Castle Rock. That was the change for him, and I didn't like. Fuck, scrap that. I think it's fantastic.
So I think that combined with being strictly a male-driven film also contributed to it not doing so well.
What? No Lockup? No Tango and Cash? Really, Matt?
I don't count Tango and Cash as purely a... it'll be a while till we got like freaking Escape Plan.
Yeah. All right, boys, let's get...
the character more than the performance does.
Adam, you're going to say something. Go ahead.
No, I didn't have anything.
All right, so...
should have brought more people because clearly Morgan Freeman didn't think much of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is also weird because Morgan Freeman, people forget this, he didn't start acting until much later in life. He got his big breaks right before this. You look at Driving Miss Daisy, Glory, Unforgiven. Like, he got very lucky that
Robin Hood.
Yeah. Well,
it was a massive success.
It was a hit, yeah. God, Adam, you and I lived butt through that movie throughout that summer.
Man, everything I do, I did it for that movie.
That movie fucking sucks.
I rewatched it a couple of years ago.
Stay tuned for the Robin Hood retrospective.
Like, if you take Alan Rickman out of that movie, it is borderline unwatchable.
I rewatched it a couple years ago, and I liked it better than I used to, but yeah, it is pretty bad.
It also doesn't help that Robin Hood Men in Tights really took the
I was going to say, we should do that in Men in Tights.
There we go. Hadley then says he... We cut to the next day as breakfast is picked up and another prisoner gives his food to another prisoner in order to give it to his bird, Jake, who he says he's going to look after until he can fly.
Oh, this not fucking... just gave his food, gave it a maggot.
Gave it a maggot, yeah.
Wait, and what's amazing... Sorry, I know. Yeah, I mean, I think The Longest Yard is almost a truer prison story than this one.
So you want to hear a story about The Longest Yard? So me and a guy I work with were talking at work about how The Longest Yard was a remake. And one of the security guards, who's like 23 years old, he goes,
oh God.
He goes, they've been making remakes that long? I swear to God.
Oh, kids.
I know.
People like this should be allowed to vote.
We are our parents now. God damn it.
I know. We see Andy working. We then cut to the prisoners watching. What is this Rita Hayworth movie that they're watching?
Oh, God.
I can't remember which movie it was. But they're watching a Rita Hayworth movie, and Red knows exactly when Rita Hayworth comes on screen and does that thing with her hair, as he says. And he says he wants Red to get him Rita Hayworth.
Andy, oh, it's Gilda.
Gilda, okay. So let me go back to that. We cut to the prisoners watching Gilda. Red is right on when he says some things are just better left unsaid.
Which is funny coming from a Morgan Freeman narration.
I've never not said anything. Just ask my maid's granddaughter that I married. Oh, wait, nope. We're not going to get in his life.
That's a different. I put the Dark Knight in the Dark Knight.
I can't wait till we get to him in Dreamcatcher. Oh my God! We see
you will die happy hearing Morgan Freeman say the word shit weasels.
Yes, we see
he's in another King movie.
Uh huh. Oh yeah.
Ah shit.
We see that the warden's. But until next week, when we review Apt Pupil, get busy living or get busy podcasting. Thank you, boys. Oh, what a set of films we just discussed. Okay, so next week, Goudreau, you want to do Apt Pupil, and what was the other one you wanted to do?
Toy Story. Because those go together.
Unbelievable. All right, boys.